Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston's Love It or Hate It Daily, the Boston Herald, is on the auction block. Also today, the story of Norwich, Vermont, its impressive number of Olympic athletes, and what they teach us about the true value of sports.
When I arrived at the town and started doing my cursory reporting, I thought I was writing a sports book. What I really was ending up with was a parenting guide.
Plus an exit interview with Linda Dorsina Forey, who was the only person of color in the Massachusetts Senate, now moving on to a job in the private sector.
Everything that I've been able to do as an advocate, you know, working on issues that have serious impact around access and opportunity to make sure that people have a chance in the private side, and I'm really excited about that.
And the stock market's correction. Is it just a blip or a warning of trouble ahead? That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with the fate of the soon-to-be-sold Boston Herald, which is on the auction block today. Three bidders, lots of lawyers, and Pat Purcell, the owner of the Herald, are meeting in a Boston law office to choose the winning bid for the region's number two daily newspaper. Joining me to talk about the auction and what it means for the news business in Boston is John Carroll. He's a professor of journalism at BU, author of the blog It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. He's also WBUR's senior news analyst. John, always good to have you.
Good to be here.
So what is the news, the story here? We had one bidder, Gatehouse News Media. Now there are three. What do we know about these three bidders?
Well, Gatehouse is a huge newspaper conglomerate, and they own 100 daily and weekly newspapers in Massachusetts. They own the Cape Cod Times, the Worcester Telegram, Quincy Patriot Ledger. They were the first bid to come in, and everybody thought they're going to get it. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, this Revolution Media Group came along. It's a Los Angeles-based investment firm headed up by a Scituate native, Robert Loring, who actually was an intern at the Boston Herald. So I'm thinking the nostalgia factor is at play there. And then a late entry, Digital First Media, which owns the Lowell Sun and the Fitchburg Sentinel and Enterprise. Interesting, the latter of which just abandoned its brick-and-mortar home, and it has gone to a virtual newsroom. So this is a group that's willing to experiment and innovate.
All right. So, and a key difference in the bids, as I understand it, is how much money goes to the Herald's owner versus how much of it goes to the employees of the paper. Is that right?
Right. So Gatehouse has offered $4.5 million in cash, and they say they'll cover at least $500,000 in employee obligations. Revolution has offered $3 million in cash and says it'll offer up to $2,750,000 to the employees. So that's one of the reasons, along with the lawyers and the bidders, the unions are in the room during the auction now, because they have a real vested interest in how this works out.
Right. So say more about that. I mean, what do we know? What will happen to the Herald's employees once this deal is done? It depends on which bid is accepted, obviously.
Well, whatever bid is accepted, they're going to cut staff. So there are 240 employees for the Herald right now. Both Gatehouse and Revolution have said they'll cut it down to 175. So that's going to make for a very tight operation. I can't imagine that Digital First, if they get the sale, they won't cut the staff either, because the Herald's circulation numbers have been in a death spiral for 10 years. In 2005, their circulation was 245,000 daily copies. Now it's somewhere in the area of 60,000, somewhere between 60 and 55, I think. Their Sunday paper is only about 48,000. This is a paper that struggles because it relies almost entirely on newsstand sales. There are very few home subscribers. I think in Brookline, there's me and there's Michael Dukakis, and I think that's pretty much it. They have to sell the paper every day off the newsstand, and that's becoming harder and harder all the time.
Right. So what is the value then to any of these companies? I mean, these are relatively low bids. odds for a paper with such a storied past, but what's the attraction for these companies?
Well, I think it varies from bitter to bitter. Yeah. Gatehouse is looking to create economies of scale. They've got enough newspapers that they can amortize their news gathering costs over the span of the dailies that they have. So you would see, I think, a fair amount of incoming and outgoing from the Herald with Gatehouse. You would see stories coming in from other daily papers, but the Herald has a very strong sports section. You might see that exported to some of the other Gatehouse dailies. I think that the value of it is in the eye of the beholder. So 5 months ago, the New York Daily News sold for $1, and the Tribune Group picked up the liabilities that they had, their operational and pension liabilities. The Herald has $31 million in debt at this point. And so that's going to be a question. And that's part of the horse trading that's going on, is what exactly is going to happen with those pension severance liabilities or the associated costs with actually dealing with the unions. The unions are going to have a very hard time retaining the position that they have, which is already weak.
Right. John, I mean, last question. This is sort of a big kind of question about the industry. I mean, I think all of us in this business root for this to be a two-newspaper town. It's good for the business in general of covering the news, of covering the city and our institutions. How do you feel about sort of where this ends up with that sort of goal in mind?
Well, I hope it stays a two-daily town. I mean, the Herald isn't really competition for the Globe, but it presents an alternative view of Boston. Mm-hmm. I used to think of the Herald as sort of a lively index to the Globe, but they really are living in parallel universes at this point. So you hope that just for the sake of a variety of perspectives, the Herald will stay in business. But just in case, I do have the domain name. It's sad to live in a one-daily town, so I'm hoping I don't have to post to that too often.
All right. John Carroll, WBUR Senior News Analyst, Professor of Journalism at BU. He's also host of the blog It's Good to Live in a Two-Daily Town, which we hope you're going to be holding on to.
I absolutely will.
All right. Thanks very much, John.
Thank you.
And speaking of buying and selling, it's been a rough ride lately for investors in the U.S. stock market. 2 weeks of topsy-turvy losses and then some gains and then some losses and then some gains and what analysts call a correction, financial jargon for a decline of at least 10%. So joining me to talk about the history and significance of market corrections is Evan Horowitz. He's the quick study columnist for the Boston Globe. Evan, always good to talk to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So first question, how often do we see market corrections like this?
So they happen pretty often. It's not all that unusual. There have been about 80 over the last 100 years, and there have been about 25 over the last 27 or 28 years. So,
More than one a year.
A little less than one a year.
Right.
But they don't come evenly spaced out. It's not like, oh, we didn't have one last year, so we'd like to have one this year. No, they come in bunches. When the economy's bad, you'll get a bunch of them. When you're in a really down market, you'll get a bunch of them. And then there'll be years where there are no corrections, no significant downturns at all. So we've got one now.
Right. And we've seen after several years of basically no corrections.
We had about 15 months straight with almost no volatility, where every day you check the market, it was going up and up and up and up and not anymore.
So yesterday you wrote in the Globe, quote, some stock market corrections are quickly forgotten, others are dark portents. So remind us of the history of some of the best known corrections that sort of were these dark portents.
So actually, some of the best known corrections weren't dark portents. So the best known correction is Black Monday, the October crash in 1987. Market fell 23%. But after that, nothing happened. No problem in the economy. Stock prices went back up. So not a dark portent, but that's one people remember. Real dark portent, fall of 2007. We had our first correction, which spiraled into the financial crisis and left us with the Great Recession. That set off a series of four or five corrections over a period of 12 months.
So, which raises the question, and you get into this in the piece, do market corrections, I mean, I guess those two examples suggest that market corrections don't always signal trouble to come, like a recession, right?
Correct.
Yeah. But they often do.
I mean, I think this is the trouble with analyzing where we are now. No, there's no guarantee that just because we're in a market correction that we're headed for a recession or the market's going to continue down. Sometimes that doesn't happen. But mostly it does happen. Mostly, if you see a correction of this size, it means something's going awry and you're likely to see another one. So if you're an odds maker, probably best to lean on the, this is suspicious. Usually when this happens, bad things happen. But that doesn't mean there aren't exceptions, not just 87, 2016. We had a big correction 2 years ago. Nobody remembers it because it didn't translate into any meaningful change in the economy. This thing, kind of thing, does occasionally happen. Now, in terms of why might this translate into a real problem, this is where things get interesting. It's like, okay, let's say this correction is signaling something, some big change. What? What's the big change? What's out there? And here, we don't seem to be in 2007. There's no housing bubble. There's no obvious bubble to prick. So I think this is sort of the big question right there. What could be going on that we're not quite seeing? And there are a couple of possibilities. One is that bond yields could be going up soon. We've got a big and growing government deficit. And with a big and growing government deficit, the government has to borrow more money. And how do they borrow more money? Well, they promise to pay back their bonds at higher and higher rates. And when that happens, it pushes up bond yields, which is not great for stocks and potentially really bad for government debt and corporate debt. This is one of the possibilities. I'm not saying this is guaranteed. This is one of the things to keep your eye on if you're worried about whether this correction becomes something worse.
Isn't there something sort of perverse about this in that one of the things that happened before this recent correction is we got good news on wages, right? Wages went up, and then suddenly the fear is, oh, wages are going up. The economy is going to get too hot. We're going to have inflation, and investors went out of their minds.
Yeah, so this is the perverse, hey, let's remember Wall Street isn't the economy angle on this, which is, yeah, this seems to have been set off by good news. Wages were going up. Investors don't like that because rising wages means companies have to pay their workers more, which means they have less left over in profits. And the thing that Wall Street really cares about is corporate profits, not the strength of the economy. So yeah, if that's actually what's behind it, then it's really hard to draw a line from there to a recession because you've got good news for Main Street, good news for workers. And to really have a recession, you've got to hit people's pocketbooks. You can't just hit investors' pocketbooks. That won't do.
I also want to sort of analyze a little bit the term correction, because the word correction means something that is wrong is being put right. So let me ask you about this theory. We're having a correction as a way to let pressure out of the system to avoid a bigger crash later.
So this was the theory I had in my head when I started looking at these corrections. Yeah. There must be lots of cases where, you know what, prices are overvalued. It's a good thing if we let them go down a little bit so we don't end up with a giant bubble that pops and takes the whole economy down as happened in 2007. It sounds like a convincing theory. I was convinced of it before I went looking. There just aren't a lot of examples where it actually happens. Hmm. Most of these things are connected to recessions. They're not one-offs. And even when they are one-offs, it's not clear what is being what air, where exactly the air is being let out of. In 87, prices had gone up a little, and then there was this big crash, but the crash went much, much farther down than the market had gone up, and it took a long, long time to recover. And there wasn't really a good candidate for what were we just sort of letting air out so it didn't pop. And then we did have a recession two or three years later. So it's a plausible theory because share prices are overvalued compared to historic norms. But there isn't a lot of historical evidence that this is a thing that happens. That is, the pre-bubble popping, let a little air out of an inflated market approach actually happens.
I want to ask you something else, getting back to this general theme that you sort of that you articulated really well, that the stock market is not the economy. The stock market is not the economy. Good point to remember. So, you know, the New York Times ran a story reminding us that 84% of all stocks are owned by the wealthiest 10% of Americans. So these fluctuations or corrections or drops in the market, I mean, to what extent do they affect most people?
So mostly they don't. And for exactly the reason that you lay out, when the stock market dips, wealth is lost by businesses, but it's mostly It's a small percentage of Americans, which is why stock market corrections or even collapses on their own rarely cause recessions. For that, you need something else. You need housing prices to collapse, right? However, we did have a recession that was mostly caused by a stock market collapse, and not that long ago, that was the dot-com bubble. Mm-hmm. When the dot-com bubble popped, we really did end up in a recession, and the leading cause was just the fact that the dot-com bubble popped. Businesses stopped investing because they had been over-investing and they were overvalued, and that loss of business investment hit GDP. Unemployment went up. That's bad for people. So it's not that it's impossible. It's that most of the time, the number of people affected by a stock market downturn is relatively small, and they happen to be the people best positioned to absorb market loss because they're the wealthiest people around.
All right. So last question. In your view, and I know you've thrown out a lot of theories here, is this a blip or is it a portent, that a warning sign of trouble?
Oh, no. Ahead? Now you're going to get me in trouble with this one. So I'll just say, when I went into researching previous corrections, yeah, I went in with a strong feeling that this was probably a blip. The fact that there haven't been that many blips in the past, that I found many fewer blips of this type than I expected, is changing my mind and giving me new cause for concern.
All right. Evan Horowitz is the Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe. He joins us regularly on Radio Boston. You can read his column about the stock market. It's entitled Market Correction, a Blip or a Sign of Something Grim. We have a link for that at radioboston.org. Evan, thank you, as always.
No, this was great. Thanks, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up, an update on the Olympic Games and the United States medal count so far in South Korea. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's head over to South Korea for a quick update on the Winter Olympics, where snowboarder Chloe Kim, at just 17 years old, dominated the women's halfpipe and won gold for the United States. After her third and final run, after she'd already secured the goal, instead of taking a victory lap, she took a risk.
Oh, she's going for it. Frontside 1080. Cap 1080, she's done it! Back to back.
Kim became the first woman to complete back-to-back 1080s, as in flying triple spins, in an Olympics. And joining us now from South Korea is Tara Sullivan, sports columnist for the Boston Globe. And Tara, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So,
my pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about Chloe Kim's run and how impressive it was.
Well, I would direct you toward my colleague Rachel Bowers, you know, beautiful coverage of the event. She was out there. But yes, this young girl has taken the Olympics by storm. I mean, she's just so irreverent and fun and funny and so ridiculously skilled at this sport, which I know, you know, can be hard to comprehend sometimes with the language and everything, but you know, she just dominated that competition beyond description.
One of the details about this, sort of personal details about this story that I liked, is she's there with her family who immigrated to the United States from South Korea, right? So you've been speaking with parents of Olympians. Tell us what you've been hearing.
Well, it's one of those backdrops of things. Again, you know, the athletes are out on the front lines, but none of them ever gets here alone. Sometimes we hear the dark side of those stories, parents that maybe push too hard, or if you watch the movie I, Tonya, you know, there can be these hard stories, but most of the time that's the exception. These are stories of families who have committed, you know, to their kids to pursue dreams, and it's so beautiful sometimes to hear these young and old alike athletes stand on a podium or stand at a microphone and just talk about the sacrifices that their parents made for them, whether it's, you know, financial or traveling. And, you know, I just think it's so nice to remember that these are often team efforts, even within these families.
Yeah. Tara, you wrote, I want to talk about another athlete. You wrote about American figure skater Adam Rippon, the self-proclaimed America's sweetheart of these games. he's the first openly gay man to qualify for the American Olympics team. Tell us a little bit about him. What do you like about Adam Rippon?
I'm just impressed by, you know, at 28 years old, this is his first Olympics, which, you know, was unusual enough to have made it at that age. His two figure skating male teammates are in their teens, you know, and they sort of laugh about a big brother dynamic. But he's just at this point in his life and here, and having been through some disappointment figure skating wise, and having sort of been confident enough to just talk about his sexuality, who he is, and be comfortable in his own skin. I find him just very inspiring, to be honest. He's really well-spoken, very funny, at times serious, at times silly. Just a really good example of be who you are, you know, live in your own skin. And so that makes you happy for yourself, but also maybe stands out as an example, as some kind of, as a role model. And particularly in, you know, in the gay community for young kids who might be struggling, that's a place where a role model like him is so needed.
Mm. I want to ask you a little bit about this sort of minor controversy. So he was part of the U.S. team of figure skaters that won bronze in a team event. But lots of folks were up in arms because they felt that Rippon wasn't treated fairly by the judges. He received lower scores than two competitors, a Russian and a Canadian, who actually fell but ended up with higher scores. So here's Adam Rippon speaking this morning on Good Morning America. No, speaking yesterday on Good Morning America. Here he is.
I think we need to get those people who think that I was ripped off on a judging panel immediately.
So there's a little bit of that sense of humor. But what happened there? I mean, how could he score lower than two people who fell down?
Yeah, it's all about, you need John Powers, now the expert on all of this from the Boston Globe, but it's all about degree of difficulty and what you attempt and what is in your routine. So sometimes what appears to our eye as just clean, you know, doesn't start from the same level that even something else with a minor bobble, but is much more difficult. So, you know, Rippon's, his strength is in his artistry and things like that, and sometimes that doesn't always translate into raw scores.
Right, I get it. One more question about American cross-country skier Kicken Randall. She seemed to be making a triumphant return to her fifth Olympics after having her first child. She's the only mom on the U.S. Olympic team this year. Oh. But her first event didn't end up so well for her, right?
Well, no, not result-wise. But, you know, from my perspective and my eyes, I thought that was a win regardless. And you know, I see it across sports more so than I ever did growing up, where you see it, you know, a Serena Williams, say, in tennis now coming back or on her comeback trail after giving birth. And it's just, you know, it's great to come back after having a baby. I mean, that used to be it. You know, you made your choice and nobody would expect that you could come back to this level of competition after having a child. So to me, Kicken Randall, she won by being at that starting line. And we'll see if she'll get another shot in another event as the Olympics go on.
All right. Tara Sullivan, sports columnist for the Boston Globe. You can find links to her coverage of the Olympics in South Korea at radioboston.org. Tara, thank you so much for joining us today. I know it's early for you over there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right, and sticking with the Olympics, let's visit the town of Norwich, Vermont. It has a postcard pretty village green, a main street lined with wooden churches, a 1930s general store, and for some reason, this small town of just 3,000 people has produced an impressively high number of Winter Olympians, 11 in all, sending an athlete to almost every Winter Games since 1984. When New York Times sports reporter Karen Krause heard about it, she wanted to find out why. So, following the 2014 Olympics, she began visiting Norwich, and then she wrote a book about it. It's called Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town Secret to Happiness and Excellence.
When I arrived at the town and started doing my cursory reporting, I found out very quickly that even though I thought I was writing a sports book, what I really was ending up with was a parenting guide.
Oh, that's really interesting. So you mentioned that you've called your book a parenting book disguised as a sports book. And among other things, you say it's the town's collective style of sort of hands-off parenting that has led to this Olympic greatness?
Right. And by that, I don't mean that they just ignore their children altogether, but what they do is they give their children ownership of their activities. So it's not as if they are steering their children into a sport that the parent, for whatever reason, has an affinity for or is drawn to. They let their children find the activities that appeal to them and then they are supportive, but are not, except for the first Olympian, strangely, who was Betsy Snyd in 1956 and 1960, she was an alpine skier. None of the Norwich Olympians had parents that would fit in with today's helicopter hovering presences that you see so much in the youth sports culture.
Yeah. For example, these Olympians in the making don't necessarily do the same sport all year, right?
Right.
They're sort of all-round athletes.
So at a time when kids are being told you have to specialize at 6, 7, or 8 if you want to get anywhere in your sport, the kids in Norwich are very happy to play multiple sports. One of the alpine skiers, Felix McGrath, was a 4-sport varsity letter winner in high school.
You tell the story of Andrew Wheating, a 2-time Olympic runner, who found his stride by changing sports with the seasons, which is just what you're talking about.
I love that pun. That was perfect. yes, in some ways, he was my favorite story in the book because it's just such an improbable tale. He was a soccer player and basketball player and really loved those sports. He would do turkey trot races and other races for fun with his family running, and he would do well in them, but no one ever got the idea like, wow, Andrew, you're doing really well in running. Maybe you should switch sports, because he seems super happy to play basketball and play soccer, so they just let him continue. Finally, his junior year in high school, the soccer coach said, Andrew, I don't want to dissuade you from playing soccer, but I've noticed that when I give you timed runs, you lap everybody. So have you ever thought about maybe doing cross country instead of soccer in the fall? So Andrew did sort of reluctantly thought, well, I'll try it, and ended up doing really well and loved it. Within 3 years, he made his first Olympic team. So for all of those parents who think their child, if he or she has not discovered the athletic passion that will carry them through their adulthood by the age of 8, it's all over. Andrew Wheating is your answer to that, your repudiation of that idea.
I love that. Karen, I'd love it if you could do a brief reading for us. It's from late in your book, where you pretty much lay out what, in your view, sets Norwich apart.
The Norwich Way gives kids ample space to discover their passions and pursue them for their own reasons and at their own pace. Most of the Norwich Olympians pursued part-time work to cover the costs of their sports. As a teenager, the alpine skier Felix McGrath found a variety of jobs, and while he didn't make much more than minimum wage, the experiences were priceless. Finding and keeping those jobs forced me to be independent and responsible and accountable, Felix said. The culture created almost by accident in Norwich can be replicated elsewhere, but it requires parents to refrain from micromanaging their children's lives and instead act as their guides to charity, well-roundedness, curiosity, perspective, and a healthy life anchored by physical activity. Their mantra is not, do as I say, not as I do. The adults in Norwich make a conscious effort to be the people they want their children to become.
That's nice.
Sounds pretty simple, doesn't it?
It does sound pretty straightforward. There's another thing that I was struck by that I want you to talk about a little bit, and that is in the organized sports in town, they're not necessarily always putting the strongest athlete in. I mean, there's a culture that sort of encourages everyone to play, right?
Right. Well, their rec leagues are no cut. So anyone can participate who is interested. And there are those in the town who may not have the nominal fee required to be a part of the league. In that case, there are a plethora of people willing to pay those fees for them. So the generosity of spirit extends from the very beginning level up through the elite level because they're no cut. You know, everybody gets to participate. I was actually at a 4th grade soccer match, and I happened to be talking to 2 parents whose son, while we were speaking, scored two goals in quick succession, upon which the coach said, hey, why don't you come on over to the sideline and catch your breath? And these parents did not bat an eye. They just kept on talking to me as if this was the most normal thing in the world. And what I loved about this is that the message being sent is that, you know, scoring a ton of goals is not the be-all and end-all. It's having fun and being part of a team and working together. And also, it sends a message that whether you're good, whether you struggle, whether you're the best or not, there's a place for you in sports. And I so strongly agree with that message. Just from my own background, I was a competitive swimmer from the age of 9 through 21. And when I look at this competitive youth professional culture now, I see all of these parents and coaches dangling college scholarships and Olympic berths and pro careers as the carrots in front of these children. Well, I did not make a national team. I never participated in an Olympics, and I was not a scholarship athlete. I walked on at USC, and I can see people looking at the arc of my career and saying, oh, that poor woman, what a waste of time. She wasted her childhood in the pool. And I could not disagree with that more strongly.
So in other words, we're looking at sports too much with a sort of eye toward the big payoff, the big
goal. The zero-sum game, right.
Instead of the value in and of itself, right.
Right. We're looking at the extrinsic benefits instead of the intrinsic benefits, like the enduring friendships you make, all the life lessons that you acquire that are supremely helpful moving forward.
So, Karen, let me ask you about a little pushback to your theory about what makes Norwich this sort of Olympic incubator. It's been pointed out that Norwich is predominantly white, very well-to-do college town. In fact, it's the richest town in the state with a median household income of $139,000. So is this extraordinary?
That's not exactly what I saw. It was under 90,000, but your point's well taken.
Yeah, so there's the point. It's a wealthy enough town, and does that explain the sort of athletic accomplishment of these privileged kids?
I understand that pushback, but it's absolutely not the case, and I would challenge anyone to read the book and come away with that notion or that idea of that's what is behind the Norwich success. In fact, the most decorated Olympian, Hannah Carney, won a gold and a bronze. She would not have made it to the national level because her parents were not well off, if not for the generosity of the townspeople who had the financial resources that her family lacked and were only too willing to share them. You have Felix McGrath talking about holding part-time jobs in the off-season to help defray his expenses. But beyond that, I grew up in Santa Clara, California, which right now is one of the wealthier areas in the country. And you look at some of the neighboring towns in the Silicon Valley, Palo Alto has become very affluent, and you don't find this communitarian vibe, this generosity of spirit as the connective thread running through the entire town. What you find instead is that when people acquire greater wealth, it almost creates greater isolation, that all of a sudden you aren't necessarily connecting with your neighbors at the grocery store or at the park. You live behind gated communities. You have the money to throw into your child's activities, so they're getting private coaches, which takes them away from the rec leagues and from the community teams. To that point, I was in the Bay Area for an assignment earlier this month and actually attended a age group swim meet. It was a beginning level swim meet, and I just saw all kinds of behavior that made me ask a swim coach, what is going on here? And he said, Karen, you know what? In your day, kids burned out of the sport because of all the mileage that they were being asked to do. It was just too much. He said, the mileage is no longer a problem. What is chasing kids out of the sport, what is making them burn out, is the parental pressure.
Interesting.
And that's an affluent area that we're talking about, just like Norwich.
Yeah. Let me ask you about one more sort of counter theory here. I'm sure you read what Adam Gopnik wrote in The New Yorker. And he wrote, Unusual excellence emerges within tightly structured local traditions, whether they are in 15th century Florence and painting or in San Pedro di Macorís, the cradle of shortstops. Hmm. So his point is, Norwich is like that. One good painter with an apprentice produces a renaissance, just like one good coach with willing kids supplies the major leagues. So Norwich produces an Olympic athlete, and boom, it kind of creates more Olympic athletes.
I actually would agree with that, and I'm living proof of that. In Santa Clara, California, in the 70s, when I was a child, swimming there was the epicenter not only of the sport in the United States, but in the world. And I was training every day alongside Olympians. Three of my first four coaches were Olympic medalists. And when you are surrounded by people who are excelling at an activity, A, it's super inspiring, and it does feed on itself. So I absolutely think that that is a part of the puzzle here.
So finally, Karen, what do you hope other towns take from your story about Norwich?
I hope they'll see that we're doing our children a vast disservice by making sports seem like a zero-sum game where there are a few winners and then everyone else, well, sorry, you just weren't good enough. I think that in Norwich, they value relationships as much as championships. And I've actually talked to Olympians who have told me, you know, I wish that I would have valued that piece of it more when I was competitive. I treated my opponents as people who were in my way to success. And so I didn't really try to develop friendships with them. And now that I'm a few years out of the sport, what I see is that the trophies and the championships and those successes seem less important. And I look at the people who have all these tight-knit friendships, and I feel sort of like the outsider looking in, and I regret that. The Norwich parents really see that as a huge piece, that you are doing these physical activities for all of these relationships you build.
Well, it sounds like a superb lesson for all of us. That's Karen Krause. She's an award-winning New York Times sports reporter. Her new book is Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town Secret to Happiness and Excellence. Karen, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And stay with us. Coming up, a talk with former state senator Linda Dorsina-Forey about her transition to the private sector. That's coming right up. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Friends and supporters use words like shocked, stunned, and disappointed when they heard that Linda Dorsina-Forey would step down from the state Senate, where she has served since 2013. Dorsina-Forey is the daughter of Haitian immigrants. She became the first woman and the first person of color to represent the first Suffolk District, which includes South Boston, her home neighborhood of Dorchester, Mattapan, and parts of Hyde Park, and she was the only person of color in the state Senate. Linda Dorsina-Forey will give her farewell address tomorrow and has become a vice president for Suffolk Construction, where she'll work on efforts around diversity, inclusion, and community relations. And I'm really happy to welcome her here right now. Linda Dorsina-Forey, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely, Anthony. Happy to be here.
And congratulations on this new opportunity. And I have to ask,
Thank you.
Why did you want to leave the state Senate in Massachusetts politics?
Wow. Well, I'm going to say first, thank you for having me. It has been really an honor, you know, to serve. But a lot of folks don't know that I've served in the state and public and state and municipal government for 22 years, 13 of those years in elected office. And so,
right, because you were in the House of Representatives as well. You were a state rep for
Eight and a half years, right. Which is a long time. But then, you know, to be able to serve and to really work on behalf of my constituents has been a blessing. But really to just be able to take all this experience and to move it forward. I think, you know, public sector is in my blood, right? And really being of service. But to be able to go into a phenomenal company like Suffolk and to work for a leader like John Fish and to be part of his leadership team and really be part of that is very exciting. rating, because I think that in order to be well-rounded, you know, public sector is one thing, because all my professional career has been there. I think now I have an opportunity to go continue that work in the private sector.
Well, I want to ask you about sort of what you want to do in this new opportunity, but I want you to look back as well. How do you think the political world in this state changed during those 2 decades plus that you were serving in elective office?
Oh, wow, Anthony, that's a big question. I'll say that it has changed tremendously, right? I can tell you that, you know, being in the state Senate, there are two of us who are people of color. I am the only black person in the Senate. There's 40 state senators in Massachusetts. The other person is Senator Sonia Cheng Diaz, who's Latina Asian. And, you know, and we work obviously collaboratively with our colleagues, whether it's around housing, mental health, you know, really about job access as well. But the climate has changed. I look at the city council, for example, right? You have President Andrea Campbell, you know, 6 women of color are now serving on the Boston City Council. That's a tremendous change. You know, you have the mayor of Framingham, Yvonne Spicer, you know, a black woman, you know, folks. So the change is happening. But, you know, we still have a lot of work to do, no doubt.
Well, I was going to say that in terms of a lot of work to do, I mean, what does it say about how much work remains to be done in that there were just 2 women of color in the state Senate? You were the only, as you said, African-American. Now you're leaving. I mean, it's still kind of a white guy's club there.
I mean, a tad, right? A little bit. I'm going to say that,
bit, yeah.
You know, just a little bit. But it was difficult, right? So I'm going to say that, you know, I've thought about this. My husband and I have 4 children. You know, we have 4 kids. When I first came in, I only had 1 son. He was 15 months old. As a state rep, I had 3 additional children. You know, I consider myself the sandwich generation. My parents are 80. My dad has Alzheimer's. My mom's mom, my grandmother's 103, and she lives with my parents. So I give support to my mom as well. And so for me, this was the right time, you know, to make this decision for my family. Although as I was going through it, you know, with my husband, you know, that no doubt also came into our mind that, wow, Linda, if you leave, you know, you're the only black senator, you know, in Massachusetts. And, you know, will that have an impact? I can tell you that we have incredible colleagues who are not folks of color, right, who continue to fight with us in the struggle and continue to do the work. You know, the Massachusetts Black and Latino Legislative Caucus, the Mass Women's Caucus, you know, the Progressive Caucus, you know, these are groups that are working together, you know, to continue to fight on issues that are impacting our communities, but not just communities of color. It's all of our communities, right? When you talk about poverty, when you talk about income inequality, when you talk about, you know, giving opportunities to young people so they could have a better life.
Before you announced that you were leaving, you had expressed interest in becoming acting Senate president around all of the... These are difficult times in the state Senate right now. Did the appointment of Harriet Chandler affect your decision on whether or not to stay in the Senate? In other words, had there been another opportunity there for you to sort of advance, would you have stayed?
No, I'll say that, you know, I supported Senate President Harriet Chandler. I think that was the great move that we could have done as a body, you know, to bring stability and really work... bringing people to the table so we could work effectively with the last 6 months of session. I can tell you that, you know, when the idea, I did look at Senate president, you know, no one knew, none of my colleagues knew back in November that these stories would come out, right, around Stan Rosenberg and whether or not, you know, he would be stepping down. But when that opportunity presented itself, my colleagues came up to me and said, Linda, you would be awesome, you know, to help lead this body. And so I took a serious look at it. And I can tell you there were 2 things that were clear. One, first was that, you know, a number of my colleagues, senators, felt that, you know, they weren't sure, and they felt that, you know, Senator Rosenberg could come back and lead the body. You know, I felt back then, as I do today, that we needed to close that chapter and to move forward, that they needed to be a new leader. And the second thing is, and then we have that leader in Senate President Harriet Chandler, right? And we thought that was important. We voted together in a caucus with our Republican folks as well, you know, saying, you know what, this is going to be great as an interim. But I'm happy that my colleagues removed the acting, because Senate President Chandler has been doing the job and she's been doing it well. She's strong. She's dedicated. She's motivated to get the Senate and get our issues, working with Speaker DeLeo to the forefront and getting bills to the governor's desk, which is critical. So that was one. 2, you know, again, my husband and I, you know, we've had these discussions for a number of months before the whole issue came up around Senate President, you know, whether it was time to step away for a moment. And so, you know, so the second piece is that, you know, if I were to be successful, now, again, it's if I were to mount this campaign, whatever, but we support Chandler. I voted for her. But if there was another option, you know, that would be another 5 years or another 6 years, you know, of leading the chamber. I would have been happy to do it. But you know what? The time had come.
This was the time.
This was the time. And it wasn't because of that at all, because we thought about it before in terms of stepping away.
Well, let me ask you about this. I mean, among the issues that you had to navigate early in your Senate career was this issue around the St. Patrick's Day breakfast. And traditionally hosted by the person who held your seat for a very long time. That was a white Irish guy. There were questions about whether you would want to pick up that mantle, but you did. And you did it well.
Thank you, Anthony.
Yeah, no, it was always fun. But I'm just wondering, what was the was there a complicated sort of decision process around figuring out how to host that and pick up that mantle that had been carried by someone else?
Yeah, I'm going to say that, you know, we all have champions, right?
Yeah.
Folks who look out for us, and we don't even know when they're going to be out there. And for me, there were two people. I didn't even have to talk to them. When the issue came up of whether or not Linda was going to host, well, of course, in my mind, I am going to host, because I'm I was the state senator for the first Suffolk district, and it's always been the first, the senator of the first Suffolk district that's hosted the breakfast. But, you know, President Bulger, President Bill Bulger, you know, when he was quoted in the Globe, when they asked him, well, what do you think? He was like, well, of course, Linda's going to host. She's the senator. It's always been done by the senator. You know, Congressman Stephen Lynch, you know, stepped up in the same article and said, what? Yeah, there is no question. It's going to be Linda. And by the way, she's pretty funny. So you all got something to see, right? And so that was pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of work. You know, it's a lot of work. I'm actually working with the delegation now, Congressman Lynch and all of them, to figure out, okay, who's going to be taking it on. But, you know, I'm still involved in terms of helping them to plan it. And so it will continue this year.
So you had two sort of high profile champions, and those are pretty good people to have. But was there sort of skepticism on the grassroots that you had to overcome?
I mean, no doubt, right? There's always skepticism. Yeah. I mean, here it is. It's the first time there's a woman, you know, there's the first time there's a black person on the TV talking about Happy St. Patrick's Day. But, you know, I have a blended family, right? My husband's Irish American. My kids are biracial. And so we celebrate Irish culture. We celebrate Black History Month. We celebrate Haitian culture. So we kind of celebrate it all. And so for me, it's, you know, once we knew we were going to do it, we brought amazing people to the table. Tommy Tinlin, a good friend. My husband's pretty funny. Myself, I think I'm okay. I think I'm okay. And the other people too.
You know how to tell a joke. No, it's true.
I try.
I can attest to that.
But I think Congressman Lynch is the best, though. I mean, come on. His jokes and delivery is amazing.
We should have had some tape for this interview just, just from those breakfasts. Let me ask you about the new opportunity here with Suffolk Construction. Vice President of Diversity, Inclusion, and Community Relations. Tell us what you'll be doing and what do you hope to achieve in this new role?
Yeah, so I'll be starting at the beginning of March. I'm really excited, really, about joining this team. They've been doing a lot of work already in terms of community and really building. And obviously the building piece, we know that they build smart. That's what they do. But really looking at diversity and inclusion and really being intentional. So I hope to bring my skill sets to the table. You know, before coming into the Senate, I was chair of Small Business and Community Development. So focused around how do we help small businesses, you know, that are owned by people of color, women, and also veterans to be able to get a piece of the pie, right? Because there's a lot happening here in Boston. And so I hope to be intentional about that work, but really to help them enhance what they've been doing. You know, John Fish has been critical around the Boston Scholars Athletes Program, which is a program that works with public high school students, you know, athletes in the Boston public high schools, but also in Springfield and other places. 4,000 kids they work with, you know, to get them into college. And that's something, you know, I look forward to really help figure out how can we do better with that. But, you know, it's a lot of things that they're doing already. And I just want to really be part of the team and to help them.
I want to ask you about one of Suffolk's big projects in Boston, of course, is the Wynn Casino in Everett. And as we've reported, Steve Wynn resigned as CEO of Wynn Resorts following allegations of sexual harassment and abuse that went on for apparently decades. Now the State Gaming Commission is looking into all of that. This is complicated because now the company you work for is involved in that. What's your response to all this? Where does this go?
I mean, I think that was a good thing he stepped down, right? I mean, when allegations happen, it's kind of like in the Senate, right? These were brave young men, four men that came forward to share that this was their experience and lobbyists. We want people to speak up. We want people to say, this is what happened, you know, and we cannot tolerate that. I would say that, you know, Suffolk Construction was picked, you know, through the process, you know, to their developer, right?
Should Wynn's name be on the building, though, when it's done?
I mean, that is interesting, right? So that's something that the Gaming Commission, I know Steve Crosby and his team are going to have to take a look at. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's something that we're going to have to take a look at to see what happens in the end.
Well, Linda Dorsita, for you, final question. I got to say, as someone who covers politics in my normal life, I'm sorry that you're leaving the world of politics. But can you imagine returning to politics one day?
I say I do imagine that, because I'm going to say an example is to look at Governor Charlie Baker and Governor Deval Patrick. Although they were amazing public servants in their early careers, they left and they did a stint in the private sector and they gained experience in the business world. And when they came back and ran for governor, my goodness, the contribution was tremendous to our Commonwealth. And so I think, yeah, you can step out of public sector. You could step out of public life and still do amazing work in the private sector. And we don't know what tomorrow may bring. But maybe I'll be back.
All right. Well, let's hope. Linda Dorsita Forey, former state senator for the 1st Suffolk District. She is going to be starting a job as vice president of the Northeast Region Diversity, Inclusion, and Community Relations for Suffolk Construction. Senator Dorsita Forey, thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.